This is Rob Leahy from Simply Rugged Holsters, and you're listening to the Shooter's Apprentice podcast.
Now, I grew up down an old dirt road in a town you wouldn't know. I still live in the sticks where you wouldn't go, in a town of 1,200 off an old dirt road, and a country boy is all I'll ever be.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Shooter's Apprentice podcast. Pull up a chair, grab a drink, or a cigar, or whatever, and let's hang out for a little bit. Alrighty. I've got just a few things to talk about this week before we get into the main topic, which will be kind of what happened to Para Ordnance. I guess we could start with what's been going on with work and up on the haul road. Because since the last recording, I've learned something that I found was quite fascinating. The first trip up with my new fuel tanks installed on the Peterbilt, I had a really screwy backhaul situation from Dead Horse. There was a fella that rolled a truck over up north over the winter, and he was hauling a dry van. And when he rolled, that van got busted up pretty bad, and I got the pleasure of bringing that wrecked trailer back. And what they did, the way they loaded that, is they put it up on top of a step deck trailer with the back of the van at the back of the step deck. And then pallets kind of stacked up underneath of it to keep the belly stable because the frame was all collapsed. And not only were the walls and the roof on the trailer, you know, structurally on sound, but the way it was loaded was super tall and it was really tail heavy. So I couldn't really get I couldn't go fast with it at all. And I couldn't get runs for the hills, so basically I had to throw tire chains almost every hill, or just, you know, if they were decent enough, just pull my way up them real slow. So it was a really long, slow trip back. And then it was also the first trip with the added fuel tank, and I was having some issues with the tanks on the truck, with one of the main tanks trying to suck air. So I had pulled into the state camp just outside of Attigan Pass. It's called Chandler Camp. And I was asking if I could borrow, I tried to borrow a bolt so I could block off the air vent on that one tank to try to keep it from pulling fuel from that tank. Long story short, when I walked in there to see if I could borrow a bolt to block off that vent, I was really surprised to find myself face-to-face with a 105mm howitzer. Front and center right there in the middle of the shop. And I have heard of the state maintenance guys blasting cannons up on the pass to initiate controlled avalanches, but I had always thought that they just used like a propane cannon or something like that. I never knew or I never realized that they had a World War II era M101 military howitzer up there, or that they fired off live artillery to bring down the avalanches. So, the state guy there, he is a little hesitant and a little weirded out that I was asking questions like, you know, does it fire live shells, or where do you guys get rounds for it and stuff like that. And he was, like I said, he was kind of hesitant to answer. And I kind of had to take a second, like, oh, no, I'm not trying to be weird or anything. I'm just a gun nut and I'm a history buff, you know, and I just kind of find this stuff really cool. And after that, he kind of lightened up a little bit and was pretty cool about showing me the gun. So that would be a pretty fun job. I'm just a little bit jealous of those guys getting to go up there and shoot down avalanches with a howitzer. That would be pretty fun, I think. Two trips after that, I had my first ever real incident in a truck. And I come around a corner, and the road conditions changed, you know, like that. I come around the corner, it was bare, sunny, dry roads, and I come around the corner, and the winds literally came around the corner. And the wind's blowing 30 miles an hour, and it was just glazed ice. And I ended up losing traction on the truck, and I couldn't get it back. You know, I fishtailed back and forth a couple times before I finally lost it. And between the ice and the high winds, I ended up going off into the ditch. Thankfully, I had an empty trailer. I wasn't going very fast. The empty reefer van probably didn't help anything. Like I said, the winds caught the trailer, and that's actually what ended up pulling me off into the ditch, was the winds catching the trailer when I was already had broken traction. So, like I said, I wasn't going very fast, and nothing majorly damaged. I crunched the corner of the sleeper on my truck just a little bit, and definitely hurt my pride a lot. You know, I was hoping to go at least a year without having any incidences on that road, but you know, it's not known as the most dangerous road in North America for nothing, and the road bites everybody. You know, if you work up there long enough, you do end up having that road bite you in the butt, and it's not really an if, it's more of a when, and it was my turn. So, you know, I did everything I could, and I learned from it, and you know, nothing was seriously damaged, so, you know, we'll be better next time. And then another thing that has happened since the last time I recorded an episode was I had to go get a new cell phone. And that turned into a huge hassle, and I ended up having to get a new carrier and a new phone number. Usually when the time comes for me to get a new phone, I will go get a refurbished one that is, you know, one model older than whatever is currently out. Right now I'm using iPhones. I've used Samsungs or whatever in the past. I'm not really a, you know, phone brand whore or whatever, but right now I've got iPhone, so that's what I stuck with. Unfortunately, nobody will send me a refurbished phone direct up here in Alaska anymore. Nobody will ship them. So I went out and bought a brand new iPhone, a brand new one. I got an iPhone 15 Pro Max, and I couldn't put my old Straight Talk SIM card in it because of the new phone using eSIM. And unfortunately, Straight Talk only does Verizon towers with eSIM. And that doesn't work worth a crap up here. I've had a AT&T SIM card through Straight Talk for a long time. It worked fine. But they would only sign me up with Verizon towers with the new eSIM. And like I said, that wouldn't work up here. So I ended up just signing up directly with AT&T with a business account. But they couldn't port over my old phone number, so I had to get a new one. And that has been a real pain in the butt. I never realized how much stuff I had tied to my old phone number until I got a new one, as well as a new phone at the same time. So none of my regular websites or apps or anything like that recognize the phone. But I want to text you a verification code, and I don't have access to that phone number. So luckily, I did keep my old phone number active for right now. The old phone's having issues, but I can still at least check texts and that kind of stuff with it occasionally. So that's made the process a little easier, kind of ease the pain a little bit of dealing with all this, but yeah, it's been a real pain in the butt. But the new phone is nice. It's got a really nice camera on it, takes pretty good pictures. You know, I've got a good camera, but 99% of the pictures I take, like for Instagram or anything like that, are kind of opportunity photos. You know, I'm out at the range, it's like, oh, let's go ahead and snap a picture of whatever I'm shooting. My phone's in my pocket, so I take pictures with my phone. Half the pictures that end up in my articles are taken with my phone too, because, you know, I never seem to know where the batteries for the camera are, the cord or anything, so I just snap pictures with my phone and make it easy. So it is nice. That's one of the reasons I always try to keep up a fairly new phone whenever I do upgrade, because I like to try to keep up to date with the cameras. And that iPhone 15 Pro has a pretty nice camera on it. And then other than that, I've just been working on some spring cleaning and working on setting up the range behind the house. I was off working all of last summer, and I didn't really get a chance to work on the house or the property much. And then just before snowfall last year, I got a dozer in here and cleared some more of the land, including a spot where I'm trying to build the shooting range right now. You know, and I pushed up a big berm at the back of the property. At the time, I had like one day to try to get all the dozer work done, so I didn't worry about trying to measure things out. I just tried to clear as much land as I could while I had the dozer in here. And the spot where I was hoping to put the shooting range at, I can't quite get 100 yards right there. I can get 93 yards. If I brought an excavator in and, you know, piled the berm up higher and pushed it further right up to the property line, I could probably get a full 100 yards. But right now, I can get 100 yards from the edge of the road, the gravel road, up to where the berm is. I can get 93 yards. And I may just put a bench across the gravel road there for a full 100 yards. I just need to verify with my neighbor that I can do that. I used to shoot in his gravel pit at the end of the road, and I don't think he will have a problem with me just putting a bench across the gravel to get a full 100 yards and shoot off into my property. But I just want to verify with him before I do that. I was definitely disappointed when I got the rangefinder out there this spring and started kind of looking at how I wanted to set things up and found out I could only get 93 yards. I could get 200 yards if I put my firing line along the back edge of the property and shot from out by the paved highway, but I would need to get an excavator in here and make a taller berm and be able to shoot that way, because I wasn't planning on shooting that way, and I left the back of the property line all cleared because the neighbors on that side are planning on building a subdivision over there, and I wanted a very clear line of where the property edge was. So I could, if I get an excavator in here one way or the other, I could either just move the berm back, you know, dig a few feet and pile it up a little higher, or I could modify and swing the berm over to the left and then get a 200-yard rifle range. But then I don't really get the big clearing area where I wanted to set up the skeet thrower and all that kind of stuff. So just some, and I got to do a little bit of thinking and see exactly how I want to set it up. In the meantime, I've got a really nice, I've got a full 50-yard pistol range that I right out the back door right now. And right now, I've just got a couple of racks that I built. One of them's got a full-size silhouette gong on it, you know, like a USPSA size, you know, gong. And that is AR-500. And then I've got some old railroad tie plates for smaller gongs. They're like 8 by 10 inches or something like that. Now, the tie plates are only mild steel, but they hold up pretty good to handgun use. You know, I got them hung up with half-inch chain, so they can take quite a bit of abuse. And I was able to get my hands on a whole bunch of them here a couple years ago. At some point, I'd like to get some more AR-500 plates and maybe a plate rack or like a Texas Star or something, but that will depend on what I can get my hands on up here in Alaska and how long we keep this piece of property for. So right now, you know, it's nice, though. I can just walk out the back door, or the front door, actually. It's actually the front door. I can walk out the front door, walk down the stairs, take a right, walk out behind the woodshed, and bam, I got a nice, beautiful 50-yard with a bench. I mean, I can walk back out to that 93 yards and shoot from out by the road if I want to shoot offhand. So it's pretty nice. You know, I've shot pistols and rifles. I've shot rifles and shotguns here, too, on the property. But I've always just kind of shot in the dirt piles or snow piles or the wood pile. You know, anything I could use for a safe backstop. And then I had the 100-yard rifle range in the neighbor's gravel pit, which is, it's only about a quarter mile down the road from the cabin. But it's still just not as convenient as being able to walk out the front door and 100 feet to the right. You know, that before I had all my steel out there at the rifle range, so if I wanted to shoot handguns in the back, I was just either setting up a temporary target or, you know, propping a pallet up in front of a dirt pile or whatever. So definitely a lot nicer than what I had going on before. And then before I get off the subject of the range, I've been doing a bunch of shooting with my little J-frames lately. So I've got a 642, a Smith & Wesson 642 38 Special. And I've had that one for a couple of years now. And then I've got a Model 60 357 that I picked up over the 2-inch barrel on that Model 60 fixed sights. And that has pretty much become my pocket carry and my backup gun. I don't have anything against the 642, but I prefer a gun with a hammer and the extra energy that the 357 Magnum offers. Even if it is, you know, pretty minimal out of a 2-inch barrel, it still does give a little bit more. It's easier to find load with heavier bullets, you know, 158 grain plus. And I've been shooting both quite a bit lately, trying to decide if the extra weight of the Model 60 is worth it over the 642 for a pocket carry. And, you know, at close range, there isn't really much of a difference. You know, shooting strong hand, weak hand, double action only, you know, it doesn't really seem to make a difference. I can hit targets with both pretty well. But once I get out past about 25 yards, or if I'm going for, you know, for strictly for accuracy, I shoot the Model 60 quite a bit better, even in double action. You know, I can shoot it a lot better cocking the hammer back and shooting single action for accuracy, or those, you know, 25, 50, 50-yard shots. I put a video up on Instagram the other day of shooting that pistol at 50 yards single-handed, you know, and I was cocking the hammer for the shots. But it doesn't really seem to matter. I can place better hits with the Model 60 almost every situation. And I think it has to do with three things. So one, the gun is heavier. So it just kind of sits in the hand a little bit better. And then two, it has better grips on it. I've got the Packmeyer Diamond Pros on that one, the same as what I have on my 44 Mag. And it does add a little bit of bulk to the gun. It makes it a little thicker for pocket carry, but they're really nice grips. They fit, you know, definitely helps with the recoil of the 357. And then for three, it's got a better trigger. The double action trigger on the Model 60 is better than the trigger on the 642, which is double action only. And so whatever the reason is, you know, if it is the grip, I think the grip probably has something to do with it, but I've just got the standard wood grips, the wood boot grips on the Model 42. I'm sorry, the 642 still, just because of it, You know, being a lighter compact 38 Special is not a high recoil round. Either way, I shoot the Model 60 a lot better, and I had actually been considering buying a Model 340, you know, lightweight, but 357. But I don't think the lighter weight is worth giving up shootability. The Model 60 is still pretty small. It's still fairly light. It carries well in the pocket. You know, in like a Simply Rugged pocket protector is how I normally carry it, or I'll carry it in a pancake holster on the weak side of my belt, which for me is the right side, so it's super easy to get a holster for it for the right side. And then I carry it like that quite a bit, actually, in a weak side belt holster with a full-size gun on the other side. Normally, if I'm carrying two guns like that, I'll have the 3-inch 44 Magnum on the strong side. And then, I actually picked up another new gun this week, even though I had said I wasn't going to buy any more for a while. Now, I'm not really much of a shotgun guy. I always consider myself kind of like Matthew Quigley when it comes to shotguns. I just ain't never had much use for one. However, I have three of them. Well, four of them now. But the three that I had were all auto loaders. The first one, the one I've had the longest, is a Mossberg 935 with the 3.5-inch chamber. And then I've got a Charles Daly Field Grade auto loading 28-inch barrel that I got for like $150 or something like that. It was brand new shotgun. Some guy won it at a raffle. He couldn't keep it, so he asked me if I wanted it. I offered him what I had in my pocket, which was not much, and he took it. So I got that one really cheap, and that's actually a pretty good shotgun. Out of the three of them, I've actually shot that one quite a bit, you know, just using just like, you know, a little fun after, you know, after church or whatever, shooting skeet in the gravel pit and that kind of stuff. I've used that one. I've shot that one a fair amount. It's a pretty decent little shotgun. And then the last one is actually also the Charles Daly Chiapa Turkish, which is, it's a Turkish M4 clone. And that's been a pretty good shotgun too. Actually, I was out shooting it today, comparing some slugs with it between this other one I bought. But I've had a couple of things come up in the last couple of weeks, making me realize that I needed a good pump action. And the first one was that I found a case of low recoil 12 gauge slugs in my ammo stash that I don't know where I got, but they won't run 100% reliably in the autos. But it got me thinking, like, you know, I need to have a good pump action shotgun. Everybody needs a good pump action shotgun laying around. And I was eyeballing a beater. I've actually been eyeballing it for a while before all this happened. The local, my favorite little shop up there in Fairbanks has a, it's like a Mossberg Turkey. It's a Mossberg 500 with a 24-inch ported barrel, 5-round tube. It's got like this camo pattern on it. You know, it's just a beater, cheap, like $250, you know, beater shotgun. But I decided to just go ahead and get a brand new Mossberg 590A1. And like I said, I'm not real huge on shotguns, but on the Mossberg, one of the things I like on a Mossberg is that they have the tang safety. And for myself, with being left-handed and having grown up, you know, my first shotgun was a Biocall over-under. I've actually had two of those with the tang safeties. So you know, I'm kind of a fan of the tang safeties. The only thing I might do different with this gun, I mean, it's just a basic pump action, 9-shot tube, you know, it's just a shotgun. Nothing fancy, nothing special. The only thing I might do different is add either like a fiber optic bead front sight or some kind of ghost rings to it. Although I might not even mess with it since I have no problem landing hits on the steel plate at 50 yards with slugs. And I feel like that's about the max range for a 12 gauge rifled slug anyway. You know, and I've got ghost rings on the M4 clone, and I was shooting it and the 590 today with slugs at 50 yards, and I wasn't shooting the 590 any worse than I was with the ghost rings on the M4 clone. But I like the ghost rings. It, you know, in low light or something like that, it might be a little easier to pick up a fiber optic and a ghost ring versus just the black bead on the front of the Mossberg 590. But like I said, I might not even mess with it and just work with what I got on that one. All right, cigar time. So as I was walking out the door to come record this podcast, I asked my wife to grab me a cigar out of the humidor, since I already had my boots on and I didn't want to track mud across her clean floors to go get a cigar out of the humidor in the bedroom. And she came back with a Gran Habano Vintage 2002. And originally, I got these cigars as like a filler on an order to get free shipping or something like that. Or they were super discounted. I don't remember. But I do remember that I got two bundles of them. And I was going to give one to a friend, and he ended up not picking them up. So I got stuck with two bundles of this cigar. The description from Cigars International reads, "This is the 90 rated Gran Habano Corojo No. 5 blend, composed of full-bodied Habano seed long fillers from Nicaragua and the Dominican Republic, and it boosts a juicy Nicaraguan-grown Corojo wrapper leaf, one which has enjoyed an extended cedar nap for the past 8 years. Now, this is a pretty cheap stick. They're priced at $49.99 per bundle, which comes down to $2.50 a stick when you buy them by the bundle. Now, the funny thing about this cigar is most places give it a very high rating. I think the lowest rating I've seen listed on this cigar is like an 89. The ones I've got here are a 5-inch by 50 ring gauge Robusto. Yeah. But it seems like it's usually the Gordo, the bigger 6x60 gets a slightly higher rating. But, still 90 rating on the smaller size. And the cigar comes in a cedar sleeve. It has a nice band. It seems well made. All the ones I've handled are very uniform, color and form and all that kind of stuff, for a bundle cigar. Now, I have nothing against bundle cigars. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite sticks is the Alec Bradley B2L Black, which is a bundle cigar. However, I'm not a fan of this cigar. And that's actually pretty rare that I find a cigar that I don't like. Now, they have gotten a little bit better after sitting in my humidor for, I think I bought these in like August of last year. So they've been sitting in my humidor for a while. But not enough. They haven't gotten enough better, but I would ever think about buying them again on purpose. Unfortunately, I've smoked a lot of this cigar now, trying to smoke them up. And I've still got quite a few left, and it's just not for me. It's not, it comes off kind of dry, and honestly, it comes off too woody. They are very proud of the fact that the tobacco in this cigar is cedar aged, considering it's mentioned in every ad and every review I could find on this cigar. And it comes with the cedar wrapper, and it's just too much. It's more like smoking a stick than a cigar, Like this one I'm smoking right now, and most of them are this way. It doesn't have a very even burn. I'm just not super impressed. However, all that being said, it's not the worst cigar I've had, and they are tolerable. I will smoke this one. I'm sitting here smoking it right now, and I'm sipping on some Boatwright bourbon, which is from a local distillery up here. It's not the greatest bourbon, but it's kind of like this cigar. It's not the greatest cigar. It seemed like a good pair. And it's tolerable. I will smoke this one, but there are better cigars out there for the price point, in my opinion. Now, obviously, some people like the flavor profile on this stick because it usually gets pretty high ratings. And I don't give cigar ratings, but I'm just not seeing this one being a 90 rated cigar compared to some of the other 90 rated cigars that I have smoked. Also, before we move on from the cigar segment, I wanted to note that this segment is not endorsed by Cigars International in any way. It's just that they are normally where I buy all of my cigars at. So that's where I go for pricing when I'm talking about the cigars in the podcast. I may start trying to get prices from some of the smaller guys that I order from sometimes, like Cigars Daily or Two Guys Smoke Shop, although usually their prices are higher than Cigars International. And I very rarely buy cigars at the brick and mortar up here in Alaska because Alaska has insanely high tobacco tax. And most sticks are usually more than double, close to three times in the store for what I can get them for online. And since I usually buy boxes, that adds up rather quickly with the higher prices. Plus, he doesn't really give a box discount where I can get box discounts online. I do like supporting my local shop. If I'm in town and I want a cigar and I don't have any in the truck, I almost always stop in there and I'll buy at least one stick when I'm in town. But I could not afford to smoke as much as I like to if I bought strictly from the brick and mortar up here. But I just wanted to clear that up. This is not, this segment's not endorsed by Cigars International. I'm not endorsed by anybody when it comes to cigars. It would be cool to get free cigars to smoke and talk about, but that is not what's going on right now. It's just where I buy my cigars from, so it seems like the most appropriate place to talk about prices and that kind of stuff when I'm giving my little reviews on here. Okay. Para Ordnance, or Para USA, depending on the timeline, might be one of the most controversial brands in 1911s, right next to Kimber. People either swear by them or they swear at them, and there seems to be a good number of people on both sides of the fence. You know, growing up in a gun shop in the late 90s and 2000s, I remember the name Para Ordnance or Para USA popping up quite a bit. So who is Para, or who was Para, and what happened to them, and did they actually make good guns? So let's start with talking about my Para. Now, mine is a Para USA, which is a United States built one. Now, there is no way to date these things with the serial number or anything like that. There's no kind of records, but I believe mine is an early US built one, which would put it having been built around 2009 or 2010. Mine is an expert model, which was basically just an improved GI model. Nothing fancy, but it had improved sights on it, drift adjustable front, rear, and then it had a beaver tail grip safety and a couple other grades, upgrades like skeletonized hammer and trigger and that kind of stuff. But basically, just a good entry-level 1911. So the oldest review that I can find online for the Para Expert is from 2012. So I think my thoughts of it being built around 2010 are probably fairly accurate. Now, to be 100% fair and upfront, I did get mine used and cheap, but it does not look to have been shot much. Very little wear to the slide rails, almost none actually, and no discoloration to the slide face or the bolt face, you know, where the cartridge sits when it's fired, and there's not even any wear to like the hammer striking surfaces. However, it has had a few parts changed out. First off is the front sight. So all the photos I have seen and every reference I can find to the Para Expert model shows it came with a fiber optic front sight. And mine has a white dot steel front sight, which I don't believe that is factory. And mine also hits about 2 feet low at 50 yards with the current sights on it. So that's going to have to be changed. I'm going to have to do something different with the sights on it. And then another thing that I noticed that has been changed that I don't think was factory, this gun has a full-length guide rod installed. And I believe all of the Expert and the GI Expert models, actually I think all the Paras, had just a standard short guide rod. And now I have nothing against full-length guide rods. It will probably stay in the gun. The only real issue with a full-length guide rod is needing a takedown tool sometimes, since the plunger cap can be a lot harder to push in with your thumb with the sharp edges on it, since it's, you know, hollow in the middle. However, the gun also had a shock buffer on it installed, and I did take that out. If you talk to the old-time 1911 guys, you'll get about 50-50. You'll get about 50% who think the shock buff is a good thing, and then about 50% of the guys don't think it should be in there. And personally, I am not a fan. As they start to mushroom out from getting beat on, they will cause drag on the slide, and they'll even cause failures. So they got to be changed a lot. And then they shorten the stroke on the slide, making ejection just a little bit less reliable, in my opinion. I usually run pretty heavy springs in my 1911s anyway. So even like on my aluminum frame guns, like my Ruger Commander, which has God knows how many rounds through it, and most of those with the factory spring until it wore out, they show no signs of peening on the frame or being beat up where the slide hits the frame and stops. Actually, the only 1911 I've ever had that showed signs of the frame getting beat up right there was on a Rock Island, and in my experience, those are not usually fit very well. All the higher quality 1911s I have that are well fit have no issues with the frame getting beat up where the slide stop hits it. Anyway, back to the Para. Now, I had mentioned in the last episode that I had noticed after I bought this gun that it was a Series 80, And I've only had one other 1911 that was a Series 80, a Remington R1, which was built by Para. And according to some, you know, quote-unquote experts, the Series 80 was a whole bunch of changes like collet-style bushings and yada, yada, yada. But most 1911 guys just consider the extra firing pin block safety to make a 1911 a Series 80 or not. I guess the early 1911s were not drop-safed, so somebody decided to add a bunch of extra moving parts to fix that. And somebody else decided to just add a heavier firing pin return spring, which was the Series 70, with no extra moving parts to fail or cause the triggers to be stiffer and creepier and everything else. So most guns these days are Series 70s, but there are still a few outliers out there that still use the Series 80 firing pin block. And then, of course, you have Kimber over there with their own special thing designed by the Short Bus Gunsmithing Academy. Basically how it works is there is a firing pin block pin that has to be pushed up in order for the firing pin to strike the hammer. Kind of like what you see on most striker fired pistols like a Glock. And then pushing this up when firing is accomplished with this little arm that is added to the trigger mechanism that pivots on the hammer pivot pin. And it just pushes the block upwards when the trigger is pulled to clear the firing pin. Now there are delete kits out there for this. On my R1, I just took the firing pin block out and then ground off the arm on the trigger mechanism and called it a day, because that gun did have issues with it not firing sometimes. With this one, I will probably add the delete kit at some point, probably whenever I have it apart to add an ambi safety. Okay, so moving on. So this particular one is a black gun, and I won't say blued because it is not. And I believe all of the Para guns are actually stainless slide and frame, and the black ones are nitrate coated. However, Para added Teflon to the mix to make them a little bit slicker and in theory not need as much lube. Now, most 1911s that I've had, they like to run wet, and this Para was dry as a bone when I got it, and I have not added a drop of oil to it, mainly because I'm lazy and I haven't wanted to tear it apart and oil it. And I've put maybe 100-150 rounds through it, just plinking out back with it, and it has functioned flawlessly. So there might be something to their claim of slickness with that Teflon added to the nitrate coating. There's no grittiness when you work the slide. It feels nice, smooth, all that stuff. Slide to frame fit on this gun is actually pretty well fit. Now, the trigger on this gun isn't the worst I've felt on a 1911, despite it being a Series 80. Now, we have to remember that while the Para Expert was fit with a match-grade stainless barrel, it is still a budget or entry-level 1911. And that being said, the skeletonized trigger, which has an over-travel adjustment and all that kind of stuff, is made out of plastic. And I actually noticed this right away when I picked the gun up, because it just felt slightly off. And I also noticed that the mainspring housing is also polymer. Now, Glock and others have proved that plastic gun parts work, but it just feels wrong on a 1911, and I might swap those out when I pull it apart to install the ambi safety. Now let's talk about the beaver tail safety. When I first looked at the gun, I actually thought that this gun probably came with a GI style grip safety, and that some shade tree Billy Bob had installed the beaver tail in his garage. It's very poorly fit, and it's kind of crunchy when you press it in. However, all the photos I have seen of the Para Expert show the same beaver tail safety, and most of the photos you can see the same poor fitting. So I'm guessing they probably just cast the parts and threw them together and didn't take the time to really blend them and fit them. It's not the end of the world, but I have seen better fitting beaver tails on cheaper guns. And I may do something about this when I have it apart. At minimum, I will try to see why it is gritty and fix that. Because I've never felt a grip safety on a 1911 that's gritty before. And it's definitely kind of off-putting. Now, all that being said, the gun does seem to function as it should. Like I said earlier, I haven't shot it a whole bunch. Maybe 100, maybe 150 rounds. Mainly because of the sights being way off. But it has had zero failures to feed or eject with the various ammo that I have tried in it, even being run dry like I am running it. So I do think it needs a slightly heavier recoil spring in it, as it's getting pretty good dents on the empty cases where they're bouncing off the ejection port. And the ejection is very sporadic, and it just kind of spits empties all over the place. So Para supposedly used an oversized or an overstrength extractor on these guns, and that may be the cause of the sporadic ejection as well. 1911s are actually control round feed, and the extractor needs to be tuned to work well. And a lot of places just try to make the extractors loose and sloppy so that they will function, and the results are usually pretty poor. Most 1911 function issues can be traced to the magazine or the extractor, because they have to work together to ensure proper feeding at the control round feed. So most people just go buy good mags like Wilson or Chip McCormick or whatever, and the guns will work. But the extractor fitment is also very important. Now, as far as this gun goes, I initially bought it just because it was cheap. It was buy this gun and the other gun, and I'll make you a really good deal on them. Now, I'm not sure if I just want to fix a couple little issues I mentioned and keep it the way it is for the most part as a beater 1911, or if I want to do like a throwback build with it, you know, or maybe set it up for USPSA, because I want to get back into competitive shooting. I'm not really sure, but I'm not into it for very much, so I've got some wiggle room if I decide to do something with it as far as building it up a little bit. Now, let's move on and talk about Para. Para was a little ahead of their time in the gun world, and they were the father of several things in the 1911 world, like ramped barrels and wide-body double-stack frames, as well as their double-action-only 1911. Para Ordnance was founded in 1985 in Canada by two childhood buddies, and they actually started out making paintball guns. And it was in the late 80s that they moved on to making 1911 wide-body conversion kits, and this is where the trouble starts. Para did not make complete guns at first. They just sold the wide-body conversion kits for guys to take their 1911s and convert them to 14-round double-stack 45s. And these, in turn, were put together much of the time by Shade Tree Billy Bob and his cousin, instead of somebody who actually knows what they're doing with a 1911. And these early conversions gained a reputation for being problematic. And then in the early 90s, they started building complete guns there in Canada. Now, I've never owned or even really messed with a Canadian Para Ordnance pistol. And like I said, everything I can find online about them is very mixed. People either swear by them or they swear at them, like I said earlier. Para Ordnance actually had a pretty extensive line at one point, from subcompacts all the way up to full size and long slide double stacks and everything in between. The Warthog is a pretty well known pistol, and as it was a wide body officer size, you know, 3-inch barrel, little short magazine, but it was a double stack. And then I also had their LDA, their light double action, which was a double action only 1911 based pistol that was fairly popular for a little while. So there, like I said, there's some controversy. You know, the guys that like Para seem to really like them, and then the guys that think they're crap. And there seems to be reasoning behind both statements. It seems like they built some really good guns, and then they also built some kind of crappy guns. And then, like I said, I think they got a bad reputation early on because of the conversion kits and people throwing them together with, you know, whatever cheap slide and frame and barrel, or, you know, not frame, but, you know, slide and barrel and everything they could find. And then, oh, the gun doesn't work, Para is junk. So it's hard to say, you know, this was 20 years ago when this was going on, 30 years ago when this was going on. So let's move forward to about 2009, when Para Ordnance moves its headquarters in North Carolina and forms into Para USA. Now, there's a couple year period here where Para really seems to be hitting the nail on the head, and they were producing some really good guns here in the United States. Unfortunately, that didn't last long. Remington Arms had Para building 1911s for them, for their R1 1911 line, starting in 2011, and I mentioned having one of those before, and it wasn't long after that until Para USA fell under ownership of the Freedom Group. And we all know what happened to companies owned by the Freedom Group, like Remington, Marlin, I think Thompson Center was bought out by them. No, Thompson Center was bought out by Smith & Wesson. H&R is the other one I was thinking, H&R NEF. Anyway, you know, the Freedom Group killed pretty much every grand they came into. By 2014, Para had morphed into part of Remington, and they had shut down the Para USA brand, and they were only selling Remington-branded 1911s, which stopped being produced around 2018. And that was the end of Para Ordnance. You know, it was born in Canada and killed by the Freedom Group. On a side note, my second 1911 that I bought as an adult was that Remington R1 that I mentioned earlier, and I think I bought it in 2014. Because it was like one of the first pistols I bought legally as a 21-year-old, you know, from a gun shop. And this was just their standard R1 model, which was a 1911 A1 throwback to the guns that Remington had built during World War II. And it was a good-looking gun. It had nice grips, beautiful bluing, and that's as far as it went. The gun was an absolute turd, having issues right out of the box. And it's actually the gun that made me learn about working on 1911s, because that damn thing just would not work right. And the barrel was so poorly fit that it wouldn't even feed ball ammo dependable. You know, there's supposed to be a little bit of a shelf for the feed ramp, and then the start of the barrel start. There was like almost like a quarter inch shelf right there. It was just horribly fit. It had headspace issues. It had all kinds of issues. As a matter of fact, I had to modify it right out of the box to make it even function. And because of that, when I tried to send it back to Remington when the bigger issues arose, they wouldn't work on it because I had voided the warranty by grinding off part of the slide stop, because I had to grind off part of the slide stop so that the cartridges would even come up out of the magazine and go into the gun. You know what? Actually, we're not even going to talk about that gun anymore. It's still a little bit of a sore subject. I never did get it to work right. It wouldn't even, like I said, it wouldn't even function with ball ammo. I ended up giving that gun to my dad to see if he could get it working, you know, with him having a lot more gunsmithing experience than I did. And he never got it working, and I think he finally ended up trading it off. Alrighty, well, I don't have a gear review this week or any listener comments. But I do want to remind everybody real quick to make sure that when you buy used guns or even new ones, to look them over really well, you know, really thoroughly. I had a reminder of this just today before sitting down to record this episode, when I had agreed over text to purchase a used Sig Mosquito from a friend. And I didn't really look it over when I picked it up from him, because we were both in a bit of a hurry when we met up. And like I said, it was kind of over text that we had agreed that I'd buy this thing for a certain price. And I didn't notice until I got it home and put it under a light and started looking at it that the slide was cracked. And I was willing to eat the cost of it because, like I said, it wasn't an expensive pistol. And it was something that I should have looked at closer. And I just texted him, you know, with a friendly, hey, did you know the slide was cracked on this gun? And he's a friend, he's a good man, and he gave me my money back for it. But that's not always the case when you buy a turd. Sometimes you just get stuck with a junk gun. And I have even had, you know, new guns with obvious defects that I unfortunately didn't notice until I got home. It's a new gun. You shouldn't have to worry about these things. But, you know, these last few years after COVID, you know, just about everybody's quality control has fallen a little bit, and things do slip by, even with well-known, you know, big name brands. Like, you know, one instance, I had a grip frame on a single action that was very poorly fitted. The chambers were rough on that gun, and it had some other indexing issues and that kind of stuff. Brand new gun from a, you know, name brand company. You know, the company made it right, but it's just a good reminder to always check guns over very well before you buy them. With something like the grip frame fitment, I should have noticed that, but I was buying another gun. I was like, oh, just go ahead and throw this on my tab too. I'll go ahead and take this one. So just a quick reminder, just, you know, if you're buying guns, especially used guns, take the extra minute, look them over really well, know what you're getting yourself into. With all that being said, I think that just about does it for this episode. Be sure to give me a follow on your favorite social media platform. I'm mostly active on Facebook and Instagram, but I do post, you know, shorts on YouTube from time to time, as well as some other places. And I also use the Shooter's Apprentice handle on various gun forms, so you may see me pop up from time to time on your favorite gun form as well. And remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can always send me an email at dansgunstuff@gmail.com or message the Facebook page. And I believe Spotify now allows comments to be left as well, if that is the platform that you listen to the show on. Or if you just want to be a part of the conversation, you can check out and join the Shooter's Apprentice Network, which is a group on Facebook. And you can share photos of your favorite toys. You can talk about the latest episode. You can ask questions. Or you can just hang out and we can chat about whatever. You know, I like to be interactive with my listeners. I consider a lot of you guys that listen to the show friends. And you guys just feel free to pop into that group and talk about whatever you want to. With all that being said, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this one up. Until next time, stay safe out there and don't shoot yourself in the foot.
Same nail too long. My ears can't stand to hear the same old song. And I don't leave the highway long enough to bog down in the mud. 'Cause I've got rambling fever in my blood. I caught this rambling fever long ago when I first heard a lonesome whistle blow. If someone said I ever gave a damn, they damn sure told you wrong.